Well, I'm Patrice Sutton, and I don't have a conflict. So thank you. I'm so pleased to be here this morning, and thank you for being here. And I wanted to just pick up first in terms of disclosure, but more than disclosure, an acknowledgement that indeed the funding that we get at our center, which is the UCSF Center for Pregnancy Exposure to Environmental Chemicals, so we get funding from NIHS and USEPA, as Liam mentioned, but indeed that funding allows us to leverage money from foundations. So the work that I'm going to talk about has actually been bolstered by being a children's center and then using that to get the funding to carry out a lot of these tasks. So our center looks at pregnancy and exposure to environmental chemicals. That's why we got such a clever name there. So the problem basically that we're addressing boils down to two scientific facts. The first is that, as probably everyone in this room knows, the developmental exposure to environmental chemicals affects not only the pregnancy, but it can affect the child, the adult, and future generations. And at the same time, pregnant women in the U.S. and pregnant women around the world, their bodies are filled with toxic chemicals. So this is our problem. And the way we address this solution is essentially from changing the in utero environment from an environment full of toxic chemicals to an environment free of toxic chemicals. So this is an overview of the three pillars of our program that I was going to talk about. The first is outreach to reproductive health professionals. So I'm so interested in what Artis was explaining because really you're at the forefront of trying to actually implement these things. We're trying to norm environmental health as part of healthcare. And then we put in the hands of reproductive health professionals and everyone we can. Essentially, we try to communicate that science broadly and to many populations. And then we try to change the rules of how hazards are assessed and I'm going to describe that further. But essentially, we are trying to get hazard assessment to love and incorporate public health into hazard assessment. And there you go. So for the first pillar, why reproductive health professionals? Well, number one, they're very influential allies. When reproductive health professionals talk, hopefully, and in practice, policymakers will listen. Oh, this has just got a mind of its own. It's so interesting. So also reproductive, we're talking about the pediatricians have been engaged in environmental health for decades, but as we know from developmental origins of adult health and disease, really, it's kind of late by the time you get to a pediatric situation. So we're trying to move prevention upstream, and OBGYNs can intervene earlier. And also, pregnancies, when a person has a wanted pregnancy, they become intensely interested in their children's health. So it is a good opportunity to do outreach and education on the issue. So for many years, our program was established in, sorry about that, it's really, I'm not touching it, right? So our program was working for many years to engage reproductive health professionals, particularly health professional societies. My hands are here. And so, what's that? So in 2013, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine issued a groundbreaking joint opinion, which essentially was the first time that reproductive health professionals said that this is their issue. And that importantly, which is why, so on the left is Linda Jadis, who's the chair of our department. We're in the Department of OBGYN at UCSF. Linda Jadis at the time was the president of ASRM, and Jeannie Connery, who was the president at the time of ACOG. So they're in Washington, and the picture I used is to point out that a lot of our efforts are directed towards reproductive health professionals trying to change policy. Because as you all know, that there's very important individual practices that people can do, but for many environmental contaminants, like air pollution, for example, really individuals cannot affect change on their own. So the opportunity to have the ACOG and the ASRM opinion leveraged the ability to go global. And in fact, just this October, we were able to go to the international, well, the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, or FIGO. They had a World Congress in Vancouver, and FIGO is like ACOG on steroids. So FIGO represents 125 countries, and it's basically the organization for reproductive health professionals around the world. So for the past year, using the ACOG ASRM opinion as a starting point, we had a collaboration between the World Health Organization, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the Canadian Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, ASRM, and FIGO. And we, over the year, wrote an opinion which was published on October 1st, which is essentially FIGO's statement similarly saying that reproductive health professionals need to care about this issue. I also want to point out that the work that we've done in terms of translating the science incorporated the science not just from our center, but from 11 children's centers that Liam had showed the map about. So it's an opportunity to basically aggregate the science and say, we need to do something about it. So the FIGO opinion has four recommendations. The first is to advocate for policies to prevent exposure. The second is to work to ensure a healthy food system for all. The third is to make environmental health part of health care. As I said, we're trying to norm environmental health. But this isn't just about patient counseling. This is about institutionalizing change so that our healthcare system, which has a gigantic environmental footprint, can change how it sources food, how it gets its energy. And so we're trying to institutionalize change, for example, work such as Healthcare Without Harm is doing. And then the fourth was to champion environmental justice, because for many of the sessions that we've been to already over the past few days, there's really core issues of racism and injustice about how these environmental toxins go around the world. So the FIGO opinion has a very strong component about environmental justice. So 12 other reproductive health professional societies, including midwives and nurses, endorsed or supported the opinion. And we had a big conference, basically, of 50 people, 50 reproductive health leaders from around the world in Vancouver, where we developed an action plan. And in terms of this pillar of our program, doctors really are now prescribing that environmental health should be part of reproductive health care. And the action plan that was developed in Vancouver is going to be put forward through a work group that FIGO has already developed to bring those recommendations to fruition. So now I'm going to turn to the second pillar, communicating the science. And just to give you some examples of some of the tools we use. So we have a whole series of brochures, Toxic Matters, Work Matters, Food Matters, which are really to increase the capacity of physicians to give patients information. Now, as much as our program is focused on policy, I wanted to just point out that actually individual counseling really can make a difference. This is just an example that I found a CDC of a case of take-home exposure of lead. But these exposures actually do happen, and actually talking to patients and doing environmental health history is actually very important in terms of affecting change, particularly for people with workplace exposures. We also publish articles in textbooks of OBGYN. We basically try to infiltrate the OBGYN literature. We have blogs to discuss some of these complicated issues, like what, you know, there's people think sometimes you're scaring women if you give them information about toxic chemicals. So we address some of those. We try to address some of the barriers that people have for uptake of the science proactively. We do a wide variety of presentations, many different venues to reach our target organizations. And we also, this is just to point out that we disseminated the FIGO opinion, for example, globally, because we have partnerships with NGOs in Europe who helped us get that out. This is just to show that the FIGO opinion, the press release, went out in four different languages. So we got a lot of global uptake in this most recent campaign. This is in the Vancouver Sun, the Huffington Post, the Gupta Guide, so you know that you've succeeded if you're in the Gupta Guide, apparently, and in Le Monde. We also do a lot of social media, and I say we, that's kind of a joke. People who I work with do a lot of social media, and this is just an example of an infographic that we used in relationship to disseminating the FIGO opinion. So this is an example of a short video that we used.
The health of your body and your environment are closely tied together. So when we expose our world to toxic chemicals like pesticides, air pollutants, lead, and plastic, we're trashing ourselves. And it's triggering problems for families everywhere. Problems like child cancer, testicular cancer, miscarriage, ADHD, and lower IQ. It's why doctors from 125 countries want policies to prevent exposure to toxic chemicals. You can help. After all, a healthier world means a healthier you.
So, that gives you some sense of kind of who we're trying to reach and how we try to reach them. And I'm just going to kind of close by talking just a little bit about our efforts to essentially get hazard assessment to love public health. So when we want to move the science, this is Los Angeles in 1948. This is just a reminder. This is just a recent article from the New York Times to point out that, in fact, the Clean Air Act has made gigantic strides in terms of the air we breathe. And this is kind of why we're very focused on public policy. So in thinking about a regulation like the Clean Air Act or any other policy, you have all this science. And so our job is, how do we take that science and make informed science-based public policy? This is an article from 1973 in the New York Times, which was talking about US EPA the Senate trying to get some science to figure out how to regulate air pollution. The point is that in environmental health, everybody is already exposed. So the longer you take to make a decision, there's a health harm associated with that if somebody is exposed to something that's going to be toxic. So delays in decision making have actual consequences. It's not a neutral policy choice. But the rules of how those regulations and how those policy decisions are made are very important to the outcome. So this cartoon just says, I've always played by the rules, but fortunately they were my rules. And so it's currently, the rules of hazard assessment and risk assessment are not necessarily my rules, meaning the rules of public health and prevention. So currently, in environmental health, we generally use systems of expert-based narrative review. And that means that kind of leaves you in a situation where you have some group of experts saying this and another saying that, and that can cause significant delays. And in the clinical sciences, that was the situation up until the 80s and the early 90s. This is a very landmark paper from JAMA in the early 1990s, which showed that method of expert-based narrative reviews that was used in the clinical sciences for decision-making actually not only led to things that didn't help people, but they led to experts would be recommending things that were downright dangerous. So in the clinical sciences, they moved to methods that were systematic and transparent, methods of putting the science together for decision making. And that's actually informs evidence-based medicine today. So in environmental health, we in 2009 began to try to translate those methods of decision making into environmental health. And we developed a method called the Navigation Guide. And it would have been nice if we could have just done it the way environmental and clinical medicine does, but you can't, because for two reasons. One is that, as I mentioned, the decision-making is quite different in environmental health. You're talking about taking an exposure away as opposed to giving somebody something that might have a risk-benefit analysis to it. And secondly, we don't do randomized controls trials generally in environmental health science. So the gold standard in clinical medicine is not really available to us in environmental health. So we had to develop a method that kind of drew on clinical medicine, but then was in the context of environmental health. Like all our work, we had a large collaboration that developed the method, and I just want to point out, this is just an overview of the method, which is a systematic review method, but I wanted to just draw your attention to the box there where you basically can integrate animal and human evidence together to make a decision that's a simple, bottom-line, evidence-based decision that something is probably toxic or not toxic, or you don't have enough evidence. And in the real world, to back up, this box that I'm showing you was actually developed by taking the system, that part of the system used by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And as you may know, IARC decides, makes decisions about what the science is to see if something is carcinogenic. And I recently, in March, had the it was a great opportunity to watch IARC's process in person. It wasn't so bad anyway, too. I had to go to Lyon, France to do this, but, you know, sometimes you have to make the sacrifices. So IARC decided that, in fact, glyphosate, which you probably all know, Roundup is a very widely used chemical, and IARC decided, based on the evidence integration, that glyphosate was, in fact, probably a carcinogen. So that was basically based on limited human evidence and sufficient animal evidence. So what's different and why we are trying to change the rules in hazard assessment in environmental health is because IARC's decision, there were two kind of fundamental reasons, in my opinion, that IARC was able to come to this decision. One was that it was they had the rules of what is sufficient evidence written before they ever looked at the data. So then you look at the data and you can just say, is this is our rule, this is our definition, and it met a pre-specified definition. The other was that IARC has a very strong conflict of interest policy. So, in fact, the 17 scientists who made this decision had to go through a very big vetting process that they did not have a conflict of interest. So these are kind of two fundamental characteristics of the navigation guide. I would just point out that the National Toxicology Program has a similar kind of method that they're really working hard to implement, and both NTPs and the navigation guide were recognized by the National Academy of Sciences in two reports in 2014 as the kind of methods that US EPA should adopt. So we've developed five case studies, so we've developed proof of concept of this method, and in summary, so I would just say, getting back to these three components, this is an artist's or a photographer's rendition of how these parts have to fit together. Because although I've kind of taken them apart, it's really part and parcel of norming environmental health and healthcare and giving clinicians the tools that they need to carry out the work. And then artist is going to show how it works, ultimately. Thank you. Oh, I do want to just acknowledge all of the collaboration part of the COTC, and also in the audience is Erin D'Amico, who is my counterpart, who runs our all of our research side of it, the basic research side, and also Bob Gould, who's in the audience, who is part of our COTC. Thank you.